So, you know, when you look at a forest and you see a mouse or a hawk or, mm-hmm. you know, all these things, you know, what are we missing by not understanding? You know, if we just look at the hawk, just look at the mouse, just look at the deer, what are we missing if we don't understand what's going on, you know, under the skin?
Well, you know, I teach parasitology at Western, and one thing I'm always telling students is that there are lots of creatures inside those animals and plants and on the outside. They're often too small and harder to study, so people, we don't know what they do. And so can I tell you stories about what I do? So,
Yeah.
I have a friend, a Polish colleague, and he's interested in mice in forests. After forest fires, mouse populations really get way, way larger. And that may slow forest regeneration because mice eat seeds. And he and other people have seen this, but they don't know why. So he asked me to help him do some parasitology.
Okay.
And he and I and a grad student here, Jonathan Vaughn, looked at parasites in mice without fires and after fires out in Montana. And it turns out that after fires, there are far fewer fleas on the mice. No one's ever looked before, so no one's ever seen that. And so it's this totally new thing that, well, what are people missing? They don't look at these creatures. And so now we have found that fires affect flea abundance on mice. You know, if mice aren't scratching all the time and distracted with the fleas, they might forage more efficiently or avoid predators better. And so the absence of fleas may affect the density of mice, which might affect forest regeneration. And so I think the kinds of things people miss is all these connections, right? People are interested in forests and probably would never guess that maybe fleas on mice might have a big effect on what we see, right, when we look at a landscape.
Now, is this something that people haven't looked at before? You know, is this sort of a blind spot, you know, that scientists haven't taken into account, or –
I would say, yeah. People are interested in forests and forest regeneration. My friend just happened to say, well, no one's really looked at parasites and the seed eaters. And so he and one of his colleagues just sort of thought it up. And then they kind of needed me, right? Someone who could dissect animals. And Jonathan did a lot of that too. But I would say it's just something people have not thought of before.
And is there any sort of barriers to it? I mean, you know, you said that people, when you first thought of it, people think it might be icky, just the ick factor. And also, you were saying that as a undergrad, you didn't take parasitology, right?
Oh, yeah, I can relate. I mean, one reason people might not study parasites is they're creepy. And, you know, I say this in my parasitology class all the time, but I started out that way. When I was an undergraduate at University of Iowa, I saw a flyer for the class, you know, parasitology, and I thought, oh, man, who would ever spend their time doing that? So, yeah. So I think part of the reason parasites aren't studied a lot is they're a little creepy. I think that's changing some, though. Lots of ecologists and evolutionary biologists are starting to get interested in them, but it's still extra work to do it.
I was going to say, so one of your other things besides the mice was actually fish in this area, right?
Right.
I was going to say, was it crappie and bluegill that you were looking at?
Right, right.
And yeah, I was going to say, is that something, you know, I grew up, my dad was a fisherman, and I know lots of people are fishermen, and they know a lot about fish, but that understanding never went to, you know, maybe the things that we're feeding inside the fish. Oh. I mean, is there something that fishermen have been missing without having this sort of extra level of knowledge?
Well, you know, fish are popular because people like to catch them. I guess that's important, right? And so related to like fleas and mice and forest growth, you know, if you want a big, healthy fish population for people to catch from, it's probably worth knowing something about the parasites that infect them. And, you know, if we know something about their life cycles or their ecology and whether or not the parasites matter, you know, we could potentially take steps to alter the ecology of a place like Spring Lake, right, to sort of like shift things in the directions of less parasitized, healthier fish, if that's the route we need to go or want to go.
And what did you find taking a look at those two fish species in Spring Lake?
Ah, well, I guess I would like to say that this is another student-inspired project, and so I really am interested in parasites. Students are often sometimes interested in parasites, and when they come to me, they say something like, I like to study cockroaches, or I like to study fish. And I respond by saying, well, if they've got something in them or on them, we can talk. So I had a student named Beth Lane, who recently finished her master's degree. She wanted to study fish. And so she went out and she was catching lots of crappie. But she did this for 2 or 3 months and dissected dozens and dozens of fish and found nothing. And so that was a problem if I was going to like advise a parasitology project. And then one of my colleagues, Tim Spear, with an ichthyology, a fish class, came back with some other fish species one day. And we opened them up and saw that there were a lot of these juvenile worms in the organs of bluegills. We did a little looking and found that this kind of worm has been found in lots and lots of bass and crappie and bluegill-related, sort of similar related fish. And so her thesis became a topic of just looking at this idea of how choosy the worm was for different fish hosts.
Yeah. I was going to say, is there something that she found that it was – why it was choosing the bluegill and not the crappie?
So the answer is no. So we did not figure out why, right? So I'm always learning about new hosts and their parasites because I'm really a mouse guy. And so all of this was new to me. And so really what we documented very well, I think, was that there was a big difference in infection in bluegill and crappie. So if you read the literature, this worm or something that looks like it has been found in many, 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 many fish species. Okay. And so people have generally sort of written about it as though it's a worm that'll infect anything, sort of. And so the first topic that Beth had was, is that really true? Right? Does it sort of use every fish that it can come across? And when we looked at the spring lake fish, bluegill are loaded with this little worm in their liver and kidneys. We're talking thousands of worms. And crappie on average have like 10. So there's this huge difference, right? And so she did a really good job. She counted 100,000 of these little worms out of these fish, right? So lots of fish, thousands of worms for fish. And so the sort of bottom line for hers is that there's a giant difference in infection levels in these two fish species. And then she and I looked at the literature, and it turns out that that's fairly consistent. I mean, people have not recognized this, but the worm does seem to be a little bit picky. So really what Beth found is that there is a substantial difference in infection rates in different fish. We have no idea why.
So is this sort of paving the way for that kind of research down the line? Because you said that difference wasn't even really that much recognized. Is this sort of the baseline, the bricks that get laid on the bottom for someone to be able to make that discovery?
Absolutely. And, you know, so it's like this fish and this fluke are totally new animals for me. And so almost every day we're thinking of new ideas. But based on Beth's research, a big difference in infection levels out in nature. The next thing that we're working on, and I have a new grad student named Sammy McCarroll, and the point of her master's thesis, we hope, is to try to figure out why. So is it because the fish are different ecologically, like live different places and bump into the worm at different rates? Is that it? Or do they encounter the worms at similar rates, but one is more resistant? Right. So do the crappie not get infected because they are slimier? And I found firsthand that they are slimier. And so that's what Sammy'd like to do, right? So Beth saw the field differences. Sammy would like to do some infection experiments in the lab. So expose the same fish to worms at the same rate and see if there's something genetic or physiological going on.
Now, the things you're observing, those different rates of worms inside the fish, will that make an sort of like an ecological difference out, I mean, as far as populations and success? And like, will you be able to see that, you know, on the macro level, I guess you could say?
Well, another great question that we don't know yet. And so one thing that we have found, that Beth has found, is that the infection levels in bluegill in this lake are higher than we've ever seen written about. I mean, they're huge. I mean, and so that's sort of the next obvious question is that does the high infection loads in bluegill affect their success or their survival? Other people have found that this worm doesn't really matter much, but we have the fish in our lake have 10 times as many worms. And so there are all kinds of questions like, does this worm, we call it white grub, does it affect bluegill success? Maybe, maybe not. You know, we'll try to figure that out. But this same worm occurs in bass, right, at pretty high levels. And, you know, could it be that the bluegill handle the worm well, but they end up being a source for this worm that affects bass, which might be affected badly? I mean, we don't know. I mean,
well, it sounds like just in general that there's less, you know, there. It's sort of like less of the basic facts are nailed down with parasite research as opposed to, you know, like just the large species, the species that you can see without a scalpel, you know.
Agreed.
So is it one of those things where, it's – I wouldn't say infancy, but it's one of those things where you're still trying to nail down just how these relationships affect – I mean it seems like there's less sort of – established science with this than maybe other biological disciplines. I mean, is that something that you run? It sounds like you're running into it, you know, in just all of these things. Is that something that you hope will change after a while, or?
I'd love for it to change, that we would know more about parasites and their basic biology in general. I do have to admit, you know, it provides a little bit of job security, right? The absence of information. But the reality is, dozens and dozens of people have spent their lives studying tigers or chimps, right? There's like this high researcher to number of individuals ratio for those animals. And we know a lot about their basic biology, but that is the reverse case for parasites. I mean, new parasite species are being identified and documented by the dozens every single month. And for those, all we know is sort of how it looks. You know, we know nothing about how it lives. We know nothing about how it affects other creatures it infects. So as far as understanding the diversity of parasitic things on Earth, it's definitely in its infancy.
Now, I mean, it sounds like that your view of sort of the natural world has changed since that undergraduate who, you know, went ick. Is there something that, you know, that people are missing in their understanding of the natural world? That they don't, you know, they don't know about parasites? Is that something that they're lacking in their overall understanding?
Yeah, well, I think so. I mean, not knowing something about parasites, I think, gives people this very limited view of what diversity is like, what life on Earth is like. And I always try to give little inspirational talks in my classes about why students should be interested in a topic. And so you know, what I usually say in my parasitology class about why it's important to know something about parasites is I think three major things. The first is that, you know, you could make some estimates and guess that most species on Earth are parasitic, right? And so think about something we call free living, like you or me or a tiger, right? Those things we see on Discovery Channel. There's a certain number of those species. Every one of those species is infected by two or dozens of different parasitic species, right? So if you do the math, sort of like on the back of a napkin, most organisms on the planet are parasitic things. So from a basic biological diversity sort of standpoint, if you want to understand ecology, if you want to understand evolution, if most of life is parasitic, you should know something about it, right? That's one thing. I think another reason that people should be interested
– some students get kind of freaked out about fact number one?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I sometimes get on a roll and don't check their eye – you know, their facial expressions every time. But I think they're sort of okay with that. The second major reason – the thing I think is important for people to know about parasites is that they have huge impacts for human beings, right? They cost millions of dollars. They decrease health for humans and crops and livestock. And one thing I try to emphasize in my classes to students in Illinois is that even though it's not the case for us here, most people on Earth are infected with parasitic things like, you know, 7-inch-long worms in their intestines or single-celled things swimming through their bloodstream. So most people, you know, there are some estimates that 3/4 or 5/6 of people on Earth have some parasitic organism in them. The reason the number is so high is because most people are in the tropics, and the tropics is where these things occur, right? It's always damp and hot, so you're likely to encounter things that can infect you. People are poorer there, so when they get infected, they are less likely to be treated. So I think there's just sort of this, from my perspective, being aware that parasites have a big impact on people and our animals and plants that we care about, even if it's not obvious to us here in Illinois. It's a big, big deal for most humans and most organisms on the planet. So I think that's another major reason people should be interested. And the last that we've sort of alluded to once or twice here is that the last thing I tell students is that even if like the basic biology or the health implications of parasites don't turn you on, they are super creepy, right? And minimally, you know, these animals provide awesome party conversation.
Now, I was thinking it might be the opposite. I feel like if you're going to tell a story, you have to do a disclaimer like, no. Okay, trust me. It's about parasites, but it's cool. But I was going to say, could you give me a party conversation or a party anecdote you've got?
Probably not on the spot. there are lots of like just weird things. Like I just got done lecturing about there are certain species of flies and we're all familiar with flies and we're all familiar with maggots in carcasses at the side of the road. But there are some species of flies whose maggots grow in the skin of humans. And, you know, you can show some pretty creepy pictures and tell some pretty creepy stories about people with maggots, you know, sort of wriggling around under the surface of the skin. Biologists who've tried to raise those maggots up into pupal flies but then sort of give up at the last minute because it hurts too much.
So a lot of people think of the weakness that they're kind of creepy. It's also kind of one of the reasons why people might like them.
I think that's true. Just the weirdness. I will say the weirdness probably partly attracted me to this field, right? It's so super fun to learn about. They're just so weird, these parasitic things and their life cycles and what they can do to hosts. The creepiness, I think we all sort of have this innate feeling of disgust. But I think once you get past that, people are really sort of they're attracted to it, right? Sort of like our relationship we have with horror movies, right? No one really wants to get hurt or scared, but we really kind of like to watch that on screens. And I think that of all the classes I teach, parasitology is one of the easiest just because people, they can't stop listening or they cannot stop looking when I'm saying, okay, and there's this one worm and the juveniles crawl across your eyeball. And the stories just never stop.
Well, was it one thing Rich told me is that we're probably going to air this one after Thanksgiving and not on the day of.
Good idea. So I guess I'll say response to that, I'll say, yeah, so the stories are creepy. I mean, people kind of like hearing about them. But as parasitologists, we often joke about things like, you know, parasitologists are fun to have as friends, but you don't want to take them to dinner with you. And so I think you're right. So our conversations are fun at parties, probably not at dinners. And I know that firsthand from my family.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.